Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us it's been quite volatile for the high-tech giants, and gold and silver seem due for a breakout. Editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated, Danielle Park, doesn't see interest rates coming down until inflation has truly been wrestled to the ground. She believes declining sales at retail giants like Walmart and Canadian Tire are a warning sign for the economy. Break out the baggy pants and platform shoes. Author of The Money Bubble, John Rubino, says today's inflation and economic climate is a lot like what happened in the late 70s. What is different from the days of disco is that gold is going retail, with Walmart and Costco offering precious metals directly to customers. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe what happened on the markets this week?
Well, I mean, it was a sort of a hesitation in the early part of the week because everybody was waiting for earnings, and you know, we've had maybe 3 or 4 weeks of earnings, but the big one was NVIDIA on the middle of the week, and yes, they did manage to put in some just phenomenal numbers in terms of earnings and the rate of change on earnings. It's just quite something here. So, you know, on Friday, within the day, it became a true $2 trillion company in terms of market cap. Couldn't manage to hold on to that. What a poor performance for the stock, eh?
Wasn't that worth just 30 bucks not that long ago?
My son bought this stock 3 years ago. Hey, where was I when he was talking about it? But people in the know had a pretty good feel for the potential of these kind of companies. Bottom line, though, it's been an AI move across the board, and some of the stocks like supercomputer, microcomputer, got ahead of themselves a week and a half ago. Big corrections, and you know, 900 down to 700, and now back up to 900, all in the span of what, 10 trading days. So the volatility is quite something out here, and not for the faint of heart, unless you just are there for the long pull. You want to just close your eyes. But, you know, people did that with Bitcoin 2 and 3 years ago when we were at 60,000, and, you know, you had to live through some pretty bad breaks in the last 2 years. So, you know, if you're there for the long pull, that's one thing. If you're a trader, you take advantage of opportunities, put some money away when you get runs like this. And, you know, here we are. You got the S&P at 5,100. Yeah, we were at 4,100 back at the end of October. So percentage-wise, pretty big run. You know, I take a look at the long-term chart. I've got a chart of the S&P going back over 100 years. And we are approaching the top of the channel lines that I've been working with. 5,400 to 5,600 is the top of the channel that I'm looking at. So we are within spitting distance here, and would expect that once we've run our course on this one, it should be a pretty deep correction. Seasonally, you know, we are now past the best of the normal seasonal run in terms of momentum. You would expect that mid-February into March that you get a decent correction. So here we are, the 23rd of February, still no signs of a pullback. But, there's a pretty good chance that when people have finally given up the ghost on correction, that's exactly when it will happen. So, for those who aren't participating in the move, just be patient. For those who are, make sure you've got some reasonably tight stops. I would suggest that the lows that we put in midweek this week are a pretty good place to put stops as far as the Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ would be concerned.
What's going on with gold?
Gold, we got a nice buy signal here back in the middle of February the 15th. We got a really nice buy signal back here at 1984 on the gold market, and have had a really good run here, $30 run at this point at the end of the week. Looks as though it's got potential maybe to break out and get through the resistance levels we had back in the fall. And if so, then, that puts us in line for potential breakout on the upside to all-time highs. But for now, it was a pretty good pop off the bottom. The consolidation has been good. So, just let it have a chance to run. Silver has been an underperformer, and it's going to have to do some catch up. And the other thing that really needs to catch up are these miners. The GDXJ, the mining index, really, really been an underperformer here in the last month or so. The we were at testing multi-year lows here just 10 days ago. And the bounce off the bottom has been negligible. That's giving it a little bit of confidence. But at this point, there's pretty good resistance. We're at 32 and change on the index. I see some resistance up at 34.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Dollar index just stuck inside this trading range. Same thing with the Canadian dollar. The trend is up as far as the U.S. dollar is concerned. So on the dollar index, sitting just below 104, and trend has been up since the first of the year. But we did have resistance, as we mentioned last week, up at the Fibonacci, the 61% retracement rally. And if anything, probably due for a correction back down to 103.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Danielle Park next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Danielle, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim.
Danielle, do the Dow, the S&P 500, NASDAQ, and the Toronto Stock Exchange look like they're heading higher?
Well, they are heading higher year to date, for sure. There's a lot of euphoria around the AI story and semiconductors and chip makers, and that's really all over the world right now, led by, NVIDIA, which posted a big revenue jump on its AI business. And so NVIDIA is spiking higher and taking basically every index that has a big weight in it and this particular sector is moving higher on that news. So NVIDIA makes up just over 4% of the S&P 500, about 5% of the NASDAQ 100. It's even information technology with 24% weight in Japan's Nikkei 225. So it has even finally reclaimed its 1989 high this week. It only took it 35 years, Jim, to make back the losses in nominal terms. Of course, in inflation-adjusted terms, it's lost about 70% of its value over the last 3.5 decades, the Nikkei index. But basically, that story of information technology being, you know, it's very similar to what happened in the tech top in 2000 when the internet was just coming in and everyone was very jubilant about the prospects for profits in that area. And they certainly did build out the infrastructure that supported the internet over the past, you know, 25 years. There's no question that the fiber optic cables and all the things that were laid during that time went on to support. However, the problem was that valuations became obscene, and that's indeed happening now as well. So there's so much hype around this particular sector that is driving broader euphoria, and people are not paying attention to, you know, the price they're paying for anything. They're just piling in, options trading, all the same speculative fever that we saw in the cycle peak in October of 21 is really back to the vengeance now. So it really tells us that the average retail investor didn't learn any good lessons from the drubbing that happened in 2022, and they really need to have another roundabout, I suppose, to get there. The problem, of course, in Canada is that Shopify is sort of our big standout in the infotech sector, and yes, it's rebounded sharply, about 62% since last October, but information technology makes up just over 9% of our TSX index, and we are much more heavily weighted on the financials, you know, 30% in the financials, and oil and gas stocks, 18%. So you've got those things, you know, just sort of a dead weight, so to speak, on the overall basket of companies. And yes, Canada, Shopify is jumping in this rebound since October, but it's still less than half the price it was in November of 2021. So I guess that's the overall theme here is keep your eye on the donut and not upon the hole, as my grandfather used to say. You know, the TSX is still not quite back to where it was 28 months ago in October of 2021. The Russell 2000 is not participating very much in this rebound. It's still off about 13% from where it peaked, you know, 3.2 years ago. And we're seeing that in everything across the board that doesn't have, as I say, these big weights in the tech and the chip stocks in particular. So I think that, you know, chips are important. AI is important. I think it will be a major factor in our lives over the next 10 and 20 years, but I don't think it justifies euphoric valuations. I don't think it's going to dramatically improve productivity or the standard of living for individuals or households or the bulk of the economy, you know, in record speed for anything over the next couple of years. And I think that that's really the point that we should be focused on in the near term. Just concern about how deeply these things can come off in the near term, even if they end up being the everything everyone hopes they'll be in the longer run eventually. I mean, again, looking at Japan's experience when it had such euphoric valuations of real estate and credit markets and its stock market in 1989, it collapsed and took 35 years just to try and get back to those highs. That's kind of typical, you know, the NASDAQ collapsed about 80% after the tech top in 2000, and it took it 15 years to recover its prior peak as well. So that's really dead money. If you go in with the crowd and buy with both hands and feet, you know, in the NASDAQ 100, as much as it is so heavily weighted in this really hot sector, still is, you know, not back to where it was in October of 21. So that's 28 months and counting. So we'll have to see what comes next.
The Bank of Canada announced January inflation rate was 2.9% this week. Is the Bank of Canada lowering the bank rate in 2024 a given?
Well, I don't know that anything's a given in these markets. Everything's pretty, play it by ear, so to speak. But the current assumption is that the Bank of Canada is looking to lower interest rates, lower its base rate, and that they will do so in the second half of 2024. A pretty modest assumption right now is they may cut rates three times, perhaps 0.75 off of top rate, which is currently 5% and the highest since 2007. On a real basis, Jim, after inflation, as the inflation rate has come off and the Bank of Canada has stayed pat since last July at this 5% rate, well, the real rate has actually risen, right? So 5 minus 2.9, you're looking at, the difference there being more than 2%. That is actually pretty tight. The big issue here, the conundrum, the rock in the hard place, is that every time you get these euphoric rebounds in financial markets, you tend to get things like junk debt rally with the stock market, which basically eases financial conditions. So it's really, without the central banks cutting, they get looser financial conditions just because of these people paying crazy amounts for financial assets. And really that takes away the room or the incentive for the bank of any of the central banks to ease financial conditions when it's already happening so dramatically in these fits and starts. So the wild card in here, of course, is that shelter makes up 28% of Canada's consumer price index. And although we saw the vast majority, about 76% of the components in the CPI falling in the latest data, so that's good. That's what the central bank's been wanting. They've been targeting this range of 2 to 3% on the CPI. So arguably they're back inside that for the first time in many months, being at 2.9%. The difficulty is that the shelter component, as I said, almost a third of the CPI, increased more than 6% in the latest readings. So this is a function of these mortgages coming up for renewal, right? So we've spoke about this before, how the bulk of Canadian mortgages were taken out with fixed terms during the pandemic when interest rates were less than 2%, when mortgage rates could be had for less than 2%. And we know that those mortgages, the bulk of them are coming up for renewal every single month now, from now through the end of 2025. So what that really does is increases the cost of carrying costs of homes, not to mention escalating property taxes, insurance, which we've spoke of before. That's also inflating shelter costs. But the mortgage portion is certain to rise unless the central bank slash policy rates back below 2% and get near the zero bound again. And I would submit to you, if they're doing that, there must be something really bad going on in the economy. They must be panicking. And typically when they do that, when they start slashing in response to really negative economic data, you tend to get a big downdraft in financial markets, a big sell-off in things like corporate debt and equities, because there's a panic over what's going on the income and sales side of the equation for corporations. So right now they're trying to keep the annualized pace of inflation within this 2 to 3% range, but we know for sure that a third of those costs are going to keep going up every month here as mortgages get renewed. So unless we have a sufficient disinflation or deflation in the other components of the basket, the foods, the transportation, all the healthcare, all the things that are required in modern life, unless you get a significant downdraft in those elements, it's going to be hard to get inflation down as we go through this renewal cycle. And that is going to be problematic, because if they've got a mandate to keep inflation below this 3%, upward bound, and they know that the cost of living is going to continually increase as all these things come up for renewal, then that's really a push and pull scenario that nobody wants to be in. So I do think that they want to cut rates. They're seeing what's happening in the overall economy, which is flat as a pancake and has been now for more than a year. They see what's happening in the rest of the world. They know things are really quite tenuous, but they've got this mandate to try and get inflation back down. So again, the more mania we get in things like, you know, housing, the more people are buying, the more people are pushing up prices, the more rents are stubbornly high, the less room there's going to be for the central bank to cut. And I think that's going to be the disappointment perhaps for people who are currently banking on this rapid, you know, cutting cycle.
Is it cruel irony that the last study on inflation found that high mortgage rates were a third of the cause of this high inflation?
Yeah, well, that's what I was just speaking of. You know, the issue is that not only that, but a TD study found this just recently this week came out to point out that as mortgages come up for renewal, households are significantly cutting back on their spending. So not the ones that are looking at renewals, you know, a year or 6 months from now haven't yet cut back their spending, but every month that you get more of these mortgages coming up that are, you know, seeing rates more above 5% when they were taken out originally at less than 2%, you're seeing a big drop in households spending. And that's reflected in all sorts of, you know, consumer discretionary spending companies that are reporting, whether it's Canadian Tire, Home Depot, Walmart. They're all seeing that there's not only this big drop in big ticket items in terms of, you know, what people are buying, but even the higher income families are moving more towards necessities and groceries and shopping at places like Walmart. So this is a major theme because don't forget 58% of the Canadian economy roughly is dependent upon household spending and almost 70% of the U.S. economy. So when the consumer's under strife, you can have all these AI companies blowing it out of the park in terms of hitting their revenue and profit targets, but that's really not the bulk of the economy in any way, shape, or form.
How important to the Bank of Canada is the value of the Canadian dollar?
So obviously we're an export-dependent nation. For the remainder of our GDP growth comes from investment and exports, net exports. And the Bank of Canada also always has to think about the loonie in terms of our competitiveness. We know that our productivity has declined for the last 20 years. We know that our per capita GDP has been dropping and that as more people have come in the last couple of years, that scenario has got worse. So the standard of living is really falling. Canadian households are struggling to sustain their basic necessities, never mind have, you know, extra income or extra spending in the economy. So they really have to try and double down on selling more things to the rest of the world when our domestic economy is in such strife. And that is the issue here because a lot of countries are in the same bucket. You know, right now, China has outright deflation in their goods sector, and they are pumping that stuff out into the world, selling their exports at below cost in some cases. And that is putting a lot of pressure on other exporting nations, including and specifically countries like in Asia, where they compete for manufacturing and product development. So the fact that Canada, you know, we really can't afford to have a very expensive dollar at this stage because we're so dependent on trying to increase the cash flows from those sales abroad. And so the longer that they stay tight, that interest rates stay high, the longer that Canada tries to keep in lockstep with the Federal Reserve in the United States, then the higher our loonie stays and the more problematic that is for this need to sell goods and compete internationally. So again, it's a bit of a rock and a hard place. You know, they don't want to cut to reinflate housing and shelter and set off a bunch more speculation in that area. But at the same time, they don't want the loonie to stay too high for too long and hurt our chances at growing our export share.
Are a number of G7 countries in recession?
Yeah, so this week we got confirmation that four of the seven largest economies, most significant economies, are already contracting, or were at least in the second half of 23. So that was France, the United Kingdom, Japan, again, back to the irony of their stock market finally reclaiming the peak of 35 years ago. They are now they were in recession as of the end of 2023. And Germany, indeed, had its GDP contract as well into the end of 2023. So the only couple of, you know, the other three are Italy and Canada, And both of those countries, as I say, had very anemic growth rates, with Italy sub 1% and Canada barely 1% in 2023. And the only standout there was the U.S. economy. So of the G7, the U.S. economy is the strongest, or has been to date. The official growth rate recently was 2.5%, but all G7 countries are projected to weaken further in 2024, and markedly so. The German government just reduced its 2024 growth forecast this week to 0.2%, Jim, for the entire year, and they'd previously been hoping that it would be more in the 1.3% range. Canada's GDP forecasts are coming down sharply as well for 2024, and even for 2025, things are looking pretty weak. So, you know, you gotta wonder. We know that the U.S. economy was supported certainly into at least the summer of 2023 with a lot of still government stimulus and handouts to households, but also investment dollars going into the energy space. So that certainly helped to elongate the consumption in that economy and help boost things. The question is, what other rabbits have we got out of the hat from now until the end of 24 and then indeed in 25? Because, you know, there's a lot of reasons for the government, the Republicans, to not want to work with the Democrats in this going into an election year. And there's, you know, they're also having problems in the housing market. They're also having a commercial real estate crisis in the United States that's infecting financial institutions and investors all around the world. So there's a lot of question marks as to how strong the economy can keep up over the next year. And as I say, that's the last one. And traditionally, when just three of the G7 economies have been in recession, the remaining four have always followed. And that's, of course, because we're so interconnected in terms of trade and capital flows, financial institutions, all that sort of thing. Typically, when you get as many as three in recession, it usually infects the rest. At least it always has historically. So that would suggest that, you know, the other holdouts here, being Italy, Canada, and the United States, are vulnerable in this particular environment.
Are highly indebted companies, households, and governments changing their spending habits? And what could this mean for Canada's economy?
Yeah, well, so, the components of our economic growth. In the difficulty for Canada was they became so unhealthy in terms of concentration on housing in particular over the past many years. Some 20% of our GDP growth was coming specifically from that sector. So now when you get a slowdown in that, based on, you know, higher interest rates and too high of prices and unaffordable levels of income needed to cover the basic necessities, then you get a downsizing, an obsession with how to cut costs. And we're seeing that with both households but also companies. And of course, this plays in very specifically to layoffs and job losses and this sort of thing, which we've seen compounding monthly here. Many major franchises have been making large cuts to their workforce. And although jobless claims have not spiked up in the United States yet, and some people look at that as a example of strength in the corporate sector, I would suggest that, in fact, it's more likely that, you know, the basic unemployment benefit is like $450 a week. And if you look at the cost structure that most people are facing today, they can't make ends meet on $450 a week. In fact, the bulk of the jobs that are coming, that are being laid off in this cycle so far, have come from the most highest paying sectors, the white collar jobs, so to speak. And those people have a cost structure that won't be covered by $450 a week. So there's a lot of incentive for them to not make claims for jobless benefits and to try and find part-time jobs, second jobs, third jobs, you know, drive Uber, do anything to try and cover the bases. And I think that's what the data is showing us, that they're trying those avenues first. So all of that to say, corporations are focused on how to cut their costs, lower their overhead, increase their efficiencies, and households are focused on trying to find ways to, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul.
Are banks making it tougher to get credit?
Yeah, so credit is expensive to carry, as we've just been discussing, much more the interest costs have risen much faster than incomes over the past couple of years. You know, the tightening that has come out of the Federal Reserve in the United States has now surpassed that of the infamous Volcker tightening cycle in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And they're sitting there, as we've said. They haven't suggested they're about to start cutting, and barring some, you know, dramatic dramatic reversal in the unemployment rate or some credit event, all of which are quite possible in this environment, but barring those, they're trying to stay tight for longer. So what that trickles through to is lenders are steadily increasing their loan loss provisions because they're starting to see a lot of defaults and deficiencies, and they're having to take back properties. There's a big pickup in the amount of foreclosure activity going on. At the same time, households really can't qualify for more debt in many cases because the house ATM is no longer cooperating. It isn't, you know, if prices aren't appreciating and the cost of living, the cost of carry has jumped so much, they're not able to refinance and consolidate their higher credit cards and this sort of thing. So we're seeing a jump in credit card balances, but we're not seeing refis, and, you know, new mortgage activity is very weak at this point. So it's not just that banks are seeing their profits compressed and to have less incentive to make loans in an environment where they're having to increase loan loss provisions on a monthly basis, but it's also that consumers are just having a harder time qualifying, as are many of small businesses. You know, the bulk of the lending in the commercial real estate sector was typically from the regional banks, the smaller banks, not the big national franchises, and they're getting really stressed in this environment as well, and they're not able to make new loans, or even if they are interested in making new loans, it's quite common that appraisals are coming in so dramatically below what the asking price on these properties is that the financing just falls through. So yes, that's all going on right now, and credit is really contracting the most since the Great Depression. So that's a pretty significant statistic.
Is the middle class in the process of getting crushed in Canada?
So just for some terms of reference here, the OECD defines the middle class in Canada as someone who earns, well, actually in any country, as someone who earns between 75 and 200% of the median household income after tax. So in Canada, that means households that earn between $53,000 to $106,000 a year, but a median income of $66,000 after tax. So that equates to about $5,500 of net cash flow a month, Jim. So if you look at things like the Globe and Mail did a survey in 2019, they said 80% of Canadians considered themselves to be middle class. And 50% of the people surveyed thought upper middle class was people who made over $100,000. Well, in fact, the annual income of $106,000 to $235,000 is considered upper middle class in Canada. And according to Stats Canada's 2021 census numbers, 30% of individual Canadian earners were actually in the lower class category, and 37% fell into the middle class category. So Canadians are generally speaking less well off than they understand or appreciate, or that is often understood when people are talking about household wealth and all these sorts of things in Canada. So once we've established those parameters in terms of what middle class is, we can see that a few things typically are considered, you know, if you're in the middle class, you're typically supposed to be able to own a home and a car, save some money for retirement, you know, have health care for your family, enough disposable income to take a family vacation, be able to pay for your kids to play sports, take lessons, that kind of thing. Well, the reality of the situation is that, you know, the average Canadian home price around $700,000. If you put down a 20% down payment at current interest rates, even a 25-year amortization, that would take a monthly payment of $3,300 just there without for principal and interest, without anything else for other forms of debt, a car loan or property taxes, utilities, all that. So if you're looking at the average or the median Canadian household earning $66,000 a year after tax or $55,000 cash, you can imagine why they're having trouble to cover median rent, which is $2,400 just for an apartment in Canada monthly, or a basic mortgage payment on the cheapest kind of housing, which is about $3,300. If you look at where the most of the population lives, you know, $1 million home is more typical, and that would require at current rates and a conventional mortgage with a 20% down, that's $4,800 a month just there for your mortgage payment. Again, with nothing else for groceries or any of those other things that we spoke of. So yeah, certainly on those stats, you would say that the Canadian middle class is in worse shape than it would have been in 2019. You know, we've taken on that much more debt, housing escalated dramatically between 2019 and 2022, and that's really put everybody on a very tenuous, or the majority or the masses on a very tenuous financial position. So I would say that, you know, that at the same time, the Canada's birth rate is fallen to about 1.33 live births per female, and that's almost half of what you need to replace the population. So when people say, you know, why are not people not having more babies in Canada? I mean, obviously there's many concerns that it could be. It could be much to do with the environmental stuff and their concern about the sustainability, understood. But there's also just a financial component there where people are struggling to pay, as I say, shelter and groceries, never mind vacations or lessons or, you know, schooling for children.
We're at the start of the spring housing market. What are you hearing?
Well, I follow various websites that show new listings, and what I can tell you is that there are on property.ca, for example, in the Toronto area, new listings have increased about 13% since January the 4th. And in my area, you know, about an hour north of the city, they've increased about 8% just in the last, say, 6 weeks. We know that the average sale price in January nationally was $659,000. Now, that was still up 7% year over year, not from the peak, which the peak of the craziness in the spring of 2022, the average sale price was more around $800,000. So we're still significantly under that. But on a year over year basis, because, as I say, the government bond market has been rallying since October, as the bond market sniffs out this slowing, this disinflationary, recessionary trends in the overall economy, the reality is, as those bond yields come down, the mortgage rates have adjusted down as well. And so that has the effect of creating a little bit more room for people to reach for property. But the affordability metrics, as I've just outlined, are still horrendous, for sure. So I think you're going to see, you know, more listings come to market, and that, because we're, you know, February in Canada is still a little early to consider, you know, the spring market, so to speak. I think probably in March we're going to see, and I would guess we're going to see more listings come to market, not just distress sales, which I already track and see that there's a lot of foreclosure activity going through the courts, but also just people wanting to get ahead of these renewals, as I've mentioned, that are coming up like a wall every month over the next couple of years.
Do you see a buyer's market ahead in real estate?
So there's a couple of ways to define that, but a buyer's market typically has a sales to new listing ratio of under 40%. And we have, you know, like I said, this rise in listings is evident when you track it in these various websites. But the question is, you know, how many of the sale, what ratio of sales are taking place, and are the new listings rising faster? At this point in most areas, it's still, well above 50% in terms of the amount of sales that are happened relative to new listings. Now, if we get, as I say, in the spring, a big increase in listings or starting over the next year, then you could very much see that ratio start to swing back down in favor of buyers. But ultimately, you know, you'd need average prices. Traditionally, an average price or affordable home price is considered 3 to 4 times maximum your household income. So if you're thinking about the numbers I just went through for Canadians, that would suggest housing in the $300,000 to $400,000 range. And as I say, currently we've made some progress off the peak in the spring of 2022 when the average sale price was around 800, but we're still, you know, about 660, and more than six times the household income, and more than that in many areas. So I don't think we're in a buyer's market anywhere close yet, and we'll just have to see, you know, how these forces manifest in the months ahead.
Danielle, where can people follow you?
So I write a daily blog on jugglingdynamite.com. I'm also on Twitter, and I have our firm website at venablepark.com.
Danielle, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. He's speaking to us from near Port Angeles in Washington State. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim. Oh, before we start, I do have a thing that I'm selling now. I've got a Substack newsletter at rubino.substack.com. So I needed to get the shameless plug out of the way.
It's not shameless. We need to know where you are. U.S. inflation and interest rates are rising. Does this remind you of the 1970s?
You know, in some ways it does. The 1970s was, for people who remember it, who are that old like me, it was a kind of a remarkable decade because it was our big currency crisis. The currency crisis of our lifetimes happened in that decade. And what we had back then was rising government spending and rising inflation. We had turmoil in the Middle East, which led to higher oil prices. We had the dollar falling hard in concert with rising inflation and interest rates going up. And, of course, gold and silver soaring in response to all of that. But, you know, in general terms, that it feels like today is the beginning of a process that looks a lot like the 1970s. Because lately we've had inflation, which was very strong in 2022 and then tailed off a bit. We had it recover some. Services inflation in the U.S., in the last report, was running at about an 8% annual rate, which is a very scary level. And interest rates went up in response to that. So now our mortgages are up to like 7% and change right now in some cases. And I think the average was almost 7%. So that's, you know, it's all very scary for people who lived through the 1970s to see a lot of these things happening again. But it's also exciting because fortunes were made in precious metals. So if history is going to repeat, we need to be totally loaded up on gold, silver, and the related mining stocks.
One thing that is unlike the 70s, back then, we got cost of living bonuses every 3 months on our paycheck. I don't see or hear of any employers doing that today.
Well, we had to have some inflation first before that became a bargaining chip for unions. And we also had to have unions, which we are only just now getting unions back. So we're creating the conditions where that could happen again, where cost of living increases are a big part of union contracts. And when that happens, that kind of embeds inflation into the system because last year's inflation becomes this year's wage inflation, which spreads out to the rest of the economy and so on. It's very hard to get rid of stuff like that once it starts. So let's hope that doesn't happen. But you know what they say, hope for the or, or hope for the worst, or no, hope for the best, plan for the worst. And that should be our way of approaching this.
Well, I've never worked for a union shop. I've just had very kind and understanding employers.
Well, you're a very lucky guy.
How's the housing market holding up?
The housing market is kind of frozen because mortgage rates went back up. So refis just kind of went away and home prices are kind of stalled at a very low level. And most of those deals that are happening for all cash. And a lot of those purchases are still by Wall Street. In other words, private equity companies and hedge funds are in there buying up houses still and converting them to rentals. So we still got this process of Wall Street money coming in and turning one of life's necessities into a speculative asset. It's a terrible thing to have happen. And, you know, hopefully it resolves in one of two ways. Either Congress passes a law that just makes this whole thing illegal. In other words, makes it illegal for banks and Wall Street entities to just buy single family housing, or house prices collapse and bankrupts all these big hedge funds and private equity groups and teaches them a lifetime lesson. Stay out of the housing market.
Gold's holding above $2,000. Can we start thinking of this level as support rather than resistance?
Not yet, but the longer gold stays above 2,000, the easier it is to perceive 2,000 as support. What happened last week is gold, after having been above 2,000 for quite a while, got smacked back down below it temporarily, but it bounced right back up through 2,000. So that still counts as support behavior on the part of the market. But I'd be a lot more comfortable if gold went up to 21 or 2,200 and stayed there for a while, and then we could easily think of 2,000 as support.
Bitcoin versus gold, your thoughts?
Well, I don't think they're the same thing, although a lot of people call Bitcoin digital gold and talk about it as the next generation reserve asset and things like that. I don't know if we're there yet. Bitcoin is a tradable asset that has made a lot of people a ton of money. Now, whether it turns into the standard central bank reserve asset out there and replaces gold, that's a stretch from where we are now. So I don't see it happening in the short run. And I am completely incapable of predicting what happens in the monetary world in the long run. So I think for now, especially with all the central bank buying of gold that's going on right now, the system is switching over to gold as the reserve asset. And a lot of the BRICS action that people are talking about out there points towards the possibility of some currencies being backed by gold in the not too distant future. So I think gold is still the reserve asset. It's still central to the monetary system and becoming more so. And Bitcoin is, at the moment, a tradable asset, something you speculate in, but not something that the monetary system is adopting as the next reserve asset.
The Russians are denying that they have a nuclear anti-satellite weapon, which means, of course, they have one, because everything they deny, they actually do. So could all of our digital money just be pulsed out of existence?
Well, yeah, space war. And by the way, the Russian thing is just, that's the U.S. Announcing something that's trying to scare our government into funding the Ukraine war. So we have no idea what Russia's doing in space. And the timing is too suspicious to take that seriously, I'm afraid. But satellite warfare and space warfare is coming. We are going to put things up there that are weapons that we can use to take out the other side's communication networks. And if that happens, that could definitely affect Bitcoin trading, because one of the things, for instance, if there's a cyber attack that takes out a bunch of terrestrial servers, for instance, the Bitcoin guys say, well, then you just go to the satellites that are up there, you know, and use them to move your Bitcoin from one place to another. Well, if we've got different countries blowing up each other's satellites, then that's a whole different thing. And it's a legitimate risk for anything that depends on digital trading. So it's not just Bitcoin. It could be basically any financial asset is at risk from satellites being blown up, from EMP attacks. Because, you know, if you've got nuclear weapons in space and you can use them to blow up satellites, there's no reason why you can't point them downward, have them detonate in the atmosphere above a target country and wipe out all their electronics. So we're heading into a time when digital assets, which already face all kinds of risks, are facing, you know, other very serious risks from the military. So, I don't know how to make any specific predictions about any of this, but I think it's yet another data point that you should use when you're thinking about asset allocation and what kind of risks you want to mitigate with what kinds of buying and selling.
A higher gold price seems to have helped gold miner profitability. What's your take on the most recent batch of earnings reports?
They were, by and large, pretty good. Not across the board. For instance, Newmont just came out with kind of disappointing earnings. But Agnico Eagle and Kinross and Barrick all came out with pretty good earnings. And if we agree that pretty good is what we got this time around, then what that means is that the big miners are controlling their costs sufficiently to let a higher gold price widen their margin. And that's a good thing overall. You know, these weren't spectacular earnings, but they were, you know, by and large positive, and higher gold helped with that. So that's an overall good thing for the major gold miners. And if gold stays high, or, you know, here's hoping, goes up from here, then we ought to see it reflected in the cash generation and the dividends of the gold miners, which is overall a good thing.
Meanwhile, some precious metals explorers have reported great drill results lately, but their stock prices haven't responded. When will that change?
Boy, I don't know, because there are a few explorers out there like Newfound Gold and Nevada King and Snowline and I-80, to take four examples. They're just putting up great drill result numbers, which means that they're becoming understandable. As they outline their properties and gain a greater understanding of what kind of gold and silver they've got in the ground, they become more valuable because they're more understandable. So you would think that the stock prices would be responding to this, but they haven't so far. And, you know, what worries me is that some big miners, you know, just swoop in and buy them up at today's prices, and we never get the 5-bagger or 10-bagger pop that we should get when these kinds of drill results become known and acted on by investors. So I'm a little worried that, that this isn't happening as soon as it should. However, if you own the stocks, you should be more and more reassured by the fact that their properties, you know, the resources that they're developing, are becoming better understood and a lot more attractive. So your worst case scenario with these guys is becoming a buyout by Barrick or Newmont or somebody at a 50% premium, which would be disappointing if you're hoping for a 10-bagger, but, you know, a 50% gain is a 50% gain, and I think if that's your worst-case scenario, then your risk-reward calculus is pretty good at this point.
Walmart and Costco have started selling gold and silver coins. How big a deal is that?
It's potentially a really big deal because it turns precious metals into an impulse buy. You know, you can just be noodling around on Costco.com and see an ounce of gold at a what seems like a reasonably good price compared to the online dealers, and just click buy. You know, you don't even have to think about it, and there you go, you bought an ounce of gold. I just bought some silver coins or some silver rounds from walmart.com, and it was a very easy process. It was like buying anything else, so it didn't take much time. And I was committed, you know, and they haven't arrived yet. So I can't really have anything definitive to say about how this went until they show up. I see what I got, and I see how long it took. But the first part of it was easy. It was like any other kind of online shopping. And I think that's a very big deal because Costco and Walmart customers are, by and large, regular people. You know, they're not your typical gold bug who knows how to go to AppMex and figure out what to buy and everything. They're just normies, by and large. And normies represent probably 50 times the population of gold bugs. So I think that opens up a much bigger market, and it's potentially a really big deal. Maybe more for silver than gold, I'm not sure, because silver is so much cheaper. I think the impulse buy thing works better when you're buying five coins for $25 each, than when you're buying a single gold bar for $2,000. So we'll see. But by and large, I think it's a very good thing.
Sure. Buy $25 worth of silver every month.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking about doing, is just getting on a dollar cost averaging kind of thing, where not 25, but some, you know, some group of coins, maybe 10 at a pop, and just letting it happen each month. And, you know, where it's almost autopilot, I don't think you can just set up a recurring buy, but maybe you can with these things. I'm not sure. But even if you can, if you just think, okay, it's the first of the month, I'm paying my bills now, let me go buy those silver coins. And it takes 1 minute to do that. It's very easy to get on a schedule. And I think a lot of people might do that, because more and more people get that gold and silver are good things to have in a crazy world like this. They just can't be motivated to actually go through the steps to do it, or they don't quite know how. Well, this solves that. You know, they know how to shop on Costco.com and Walmart.com. So I think that we're going to see dramatic increases in percentage terms from where these guys started. In other words, from last month's sales by Walmart and Costco, we're going to see dramatic increases from there, and we'll just see where it goes.
Well, it seems to me if it catches on, that would put a bigger demand on the precious metals and drive up the price. Is that the logical progression here?
Oh, heck yeah. You know, if you see Costco or Walmart's style volumes of precious metals being bought, Walmart and Costco have to go get more from somewhere, right? So that creates increasing demand that wasn't there before at various points in the supply chain, and it ought to end up driving the price of silver and gold up. I mean, at first it'll drive the premiums up, right, on the coins and the rounds, but that will lead to higher spot prices at some point. So yeah, you know, other things being equal, it's yet another reason to think demand is going to go up, because you got central bank buying really aggressively in the gold space, and you've got solar power and electric cars, and now investors in the silver market who are all coming in pretty good. By the way, a sideline to the Walmart and Costco story, I went to a local coin dealer here just to check out what they have, and they had zero silver bullion. And what they said was that everybody wants silver and nobody's selling it, so they just have a wish list. They've got people's names on a sheet of paper, and when some silver comes in, they call the people on that list to see if anybody wants it. So that's another sign. By the way, what that means is that they can charge a higher premium for silver when it comes in, because they know they've got a captive audience. You know, people really want what they're selling. And that, too, will drive up the spot price eventually. So we've got some really good we've got some good trends, especially in silver, I think, because silver is just hard to get. You know, it's in shortage out there, apparently, according to the coin dealer here. So if Walmart and Costco come in and take a bunch more silver off the market, that's going to make it that much tighter for individuals. So I think it's a good deal. I think silver ought to go up. I mean, barring a deep recession, which is kind of likely at this point this year, but at the other end of it, when the Fed comes in and starts liquefying the system with insane amounts of newly created currency, then I think silver has a long way to run. I don't think $100 an ounce is anyway out of bounds now.
Mexico's president just proposed a ban on open pit mining. How serious is this for the big miners?
Potentially in context, because that would be a big deal for, obviously, for open pit miners, and Mexico is a big mining jurisdiction. But other countries have been doing not similar things, but equally scary things, like Panama just closed one of the biggest copper mines in the world, and Chile just nationalized their lithium deposit. So you're seeing a lot of countries out there either ask for better terms from miners or basically just shut down parts of their mining industry. And that's, first of all, that's good for commodity prices because it limits supply, but it's bad for the miners who are directly hit by this. So it means that if you're going to be an investor in the commodity space, especially with the miners, you need to be paying very good attention to where a miner's operations are. and what the political picture is in a place like that. So I don't think you can even trust Canada or the U.S. anymore, because our politics are so variable now and so hard to predict that you just never know what any country is going to do. So that makes me very nervous about mining in general, because you can't just go, oh, okay, I'm going to buy all the copper miners, because then one of the big ones on your list gets hit the way First Quantum did with the Cobre Panama mine in Panama, and then you know, they're existentially threatened because one of their big properties just became worth zero. So this is something that's going to require a lot more thought and a lot more analysis than maybe it did 5 years ago.
Well, maybe Mexico can afford to get rid of open pit mining because avocados are so expensive now. So expensive, the drug cartels are now in the avocado business.
You know, okay, funny personal story here. There's a Costco has these, you know, prepackaged little things of avocado that my wife really likes because they don't go bad as fast as regular avocados do. Costco, last time I went in, didn't have them anymore. So we have a bit of a family crisis here. You know, how's my wife going to get avocados if she has to actually buy the avocados themselves? And now you're telling me that the price of those avocados that we go out and buy is going to be way up. So I'm not liking that part of the story at all, Jim.
Yeah, well, truckloads of avocados are being hijacked at machine gun point. So they're worth a bit. Uranium has been the big winner in the commodities space. What's your outlook for the coming year?
I think the outlook for uranium and for nuclear power in general are great. And part of the reason why uranium, which has gone up dramatically in the last year, is still looking really good going forward, is that the structure of the market is changing. When we talk about uranium going up in price, in the past we've been talking about the spot price. And now a lot of deals are being done with longer terms, where a nuclear plant will buy its uranium in the futures market for a year or 2 years or 5 years or whatever at a fixed price. And what that does is it allows you, when you're looking at a uranium miner, to know what a big part of their uranium is going to be sold for years in advance, which is different from the way it is in most other parts of the commodities market, right? Because they're, you know, an oil company, the price of oil bounces all over the place. But if you've got a five-year deal in the uranium space for, you know, 30 or 40% of the uranium you mine, then you're a much more stable company than you're an oil company or a gas company or something like that. So you deserve a higher valuation. So that's the story of the uranium miners going forward, is that they're kind of premium commodity stocks because so much of their business is, if not guaranteed, at least relatively certain for years in advance.
What's your favorite sector right now?
Well, you know, I think operationally uranium is just great. You really can't. You can't compare anything else to that because of what I just talked about. Silver is super cheap. I think precious metals is just pretty spectacular right now. We'll look back on it at today's prices, especially silver's price, and go, oh my God, should have sold my kids and bought silver, because there's just not that much of it. You know, so it's kind of in a shortage right now, and investment demand is rising at the same time. Solar panels are, you know, the demand for solar panels are growing. And there's some silver in each solar panel. And the new generation of solar panels that are coming out use more silver than the old generation. So you've got this new sector, solar power, taking up more and more of the available silver. At the same time, investors really want silver coins and silver rounds, and they can't get them very easily, and they're paying high premiums for them when they can get them. So I think that there's a very decent chance that because the you know, the financial system is spinning out of control right now, because all government finances in terms of the debt that they're taking on have gone parabolic. You know, the U.S. debt is just going straight up, and so is the interest on that debt, and that's a debt spiral. So when you get countries, especially major countries, drifting into a financial debt spiral, you really want to own precious metals. And as people figure that out, they're going to bid gold and silver up through the roof. So I like gold and silver a lot. I'm worried about a recession in the short run pulling everything down. giving, you know, gold bugs a trading loss maybe through most of the rest of this year. But when the economy tanks, the government is bailing out everybody in sight, the Fed is printing crazy amounts of money and pushing interest rates down to negative levels again, that's going to be paradise for precious metals, and you have to be there when that happens.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money. Where can people follow you?
I'm at rubino.substack.com, and I am doing a newsletter there that's actionable stuff oriented on the subjects we just talked about.
My guest has been John Rubino, and that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Danielle Park, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.